is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Some big plays at the Packers practice. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports in Green Bay, where the Packers are wrapping up a week of OTA practices. A 60-yard bomb for a touchdown from Jordan Love to wide receiver Dontavian Wicks. Offensive coach Jason Vrabel on how Wicks has improved.
I think he's matured so much. You know, he's always been a hard worker. He's always practiced really, really hard. But it's just, I think mentally, he was just, you know, kind of some days going like this, you know, and you could feel the, it was almost like the whole world's weighing on him. I just said, man, like, just let your work take care of itself.
Baseball, the Brewers opening a three-game weekend series tonight in Philadelphia. In golf, round two of the U.S. Women's Open at Erin Hills, just outside of Hartford, Wisconsin. Yolimi Noh from the U.S. atop the leaderboard after chipping in for an eagle on the par five at 14.
Well, U.S. Opens are always very grand, and coming to Erin Hills definitely lived up to the expectations. It's an incredible golf course.
That's golfer Yolimi Noh with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
This is for people who watched me anchoring the news at Channel 13. My last day at TV 13 was 20 years ago yesterday.
Oh, I'm old now too.
Well, yeah, that was my whole point.
And I was too when you stopped working at TV.
That's what I get all the time now, is people come up and they go, oh, were you on TV? I'm like, yeah. And then I go, don't say it. I watched you when I was a little kid. I'm like, yikes.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Looking for the game? Find us over the air for sports coverage on Civic Media stations.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Evidently, Doge Boy's heading for the exit. Evidently, he will be leaving his Department of Government Efficiency post, basically with his tail between his legs, because, look, Doge has been really an utter failure, achieving only, well, I would argue what their desired goal for chaos and theft was. So I guess that is success, right? They got what they wanted, but evidently leaving as Trump's top advisor and slash and burn. And his legacy will be one that will be interesting. They did gut USAID jobs. They did $30 billion. They claim they're saving. And how are they saving that? Well, they're slashing jobs and operations across the globe. Mission accomplished, I guess. You know, help with, you know, making the rest of the globe, especially the poor developing countries, making them suffer, basically just killing them off early. Yeah, that, I guess. They've canceled contracts. They're claiming about $15 billion in canceled contracts to businesses that, you know, cost more people their jobs. They're claiming $10 billion in payroll deductions through workforce reductions and streamlining. That's going to cost more jobs. And the thing is this is what running government like a business gets you. And it is my hope that, you know, all the people who lost jobs, I hope they voted for Trump. Because at least, you know, you go, this is what you asked for. You got what you wanted. And the thing is, you know, the fallout from us moving away from helping the rest of the world is going to be twofold. One, you're going to have chaos, which is happening, violence and chaos across many of these regions. And eventually the Chinese are going to fill that gap. But ProPublica had a piece where they're saying, look, American diplomats in at least two countries have recently delivered internal reports to Washington that reflect a grim new reality taking hold abroad. The Trump administration's sudden withdrawal of foreign aid is bringing about violence and chaos that many had warned would come, including me. Now, what I think is interesting is Marco Rubio, you know, our Secretary of State, was asked about it. And you would think, you know, you would think might have a better response than, you know, it's all lies and false. You think you would have a better response? You know, you've got some of the smartest people in the think tank world who've gamed this stuff out. You could get a better message because there's no disputing the reality that people are dying because of the Trump administration. It's just not there because you've pulled food away from children in desperate, desperate countries. And look, do they care about those people in those countries? No, they're pulling food away from people in this country. So let's not say, well, it's just those people. These folks want chaos. They want suffering. And I would argue, you know, what the right loves to talk about is the left believes in eugenics and decreasing the surplus population. Hello? Hello? Have you been paying attention? Now, again, you would think Rubio and company would have at least something. And I would have had more respect for Rubio who, if he just came out and said, I don't care. At least he's honest. At least they're honest by going, you know, we don't care about any of those people. We barely care about our own people. What makes you think that we care about someone in a foreign country when we don't want foreigners in our country or anyone, really? So interesting little bit. So we'll see where that takes us. Hey, gold star for us globally. I'm sure our approval ratings will go up and the rest of the world will embrace us with open arms whenever we ask. But my favorite thing this week is, and this is going to stick, it's rare that I jump on the meme wagon, but taco trade? Taco Trump? Yeah, that's going to stick. And it's going to sting because it's simple, it's easy. Trump always chickens out because he does. That is his MO. That's what he does. He makes these grandiose claims. He does these horrible, stupid things. And then, well, does something else, declares victory and moves on, never admits defeat. And the thing is this taco thing? Oh, this Trump always chickens out thing, this can be applied just about anything. So the memes have been very, very interesting. And look, you know, good. This is gonna sting. This is going to hit the spot. Every emoji I've, you know, people have sent me texts with the taco, and I know exactly what they're saying. And like I said, it could be anything. It could be taco tariffs. It could be taco Putin. It could be taco national debt. It could be taco anything. But it means Trump, the surrender monkey that he is. This is going to stick. And the thing is, the thing that's brilliant about this is there was no strategist behind this. There was no Democrats behind it. This was organic, man. This just happened. And I give CNBC's Megan Kinsella credit. She asked the question, took stones to do it. Her question was, they're saying Trump always chickens out on your tariff threats, and that's why the markets are higher this week. What's your response to that? And he didn't know what hit him. But he didn't revert back to what he always does. That's a nasty question. It's the nastiest question. You're a nasty person. And I got to think, she's never going to be invited back to the press gaggle ever again. But this gonna stick. And good. He deserves it, because what it does is it does exemplify what he's done for years and gotten away with. So going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the coming days, weeks, and months, especially now that the federal courts have said no, your trade tariffs, they're illegal. And what you've got is you got Trump and his aides rushing to figure out what they're going to do, how they're going to bring this chaos tool back to life. Can they strong arm Republicans to pass something? I don't think so. Not even close. There's talk that they're going to go to the Supreme Court to try and get the Supreme Court on his side. The Constitution's pretty clear in my view. I'm not a constitutional scholar. Don't pretend to be one. Don't pretend to play one on the radio or TV. But seems fairly clear that that's Congress. Now, Congress has, you know, given some of that a little bit of that power in emergency situations. And I guess that's their argument. But it'll be interesting to see what this Supreme Court does. And I got to tell you, I don't know. I don't know what the Roberts Court will do, considering they've given so much power to this administration. And, you know, you go back to the ruling of if the president does it, it's not illegal. You know, where does that play into all of this? So a lot of intrigue with the Supreme Court, with the Roberts Court, and what Roberts' legacy is going to be. Is he going to be the guy who, on his watch, we anoint a king, you know, a taco king? See, it fits, doesn't it? But we're going to see. I'm assuming that they're going to try and fast track this and see where it takes us. As I've said, I'm someone who believes that tariffs can and should be used in certain circumstances with a much broader plan. And I think Biden was doing some of that and doing it well. But this Trump style ain't working. And look, I've had people who've known Trump, and I've even had one guy who was in a room back when the old USFL was negotiating their contract. Trump came in and just blew the whole thing up. And the Players Association actually did get a much better deal. The owners got screwed, but, you know, the players a little bit better. That's Trump's MO. And he declared victory because he was, you know, Mr. Art of the Deal. Mr. Art of the Deal. I want to hear your thoughts. Does it stick? Trump always chickens out. Does it stick? And does it sting? Are we going to see taco trucks lining the White House? Are we going to see taco trucks following the motorcade? Will there be a taco truck on every corner? Wait a second. Didn't someone say that? Oh, yeah. Trump did. Trump did that. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I said, federal courts have said, no, your tariff policy, no, you can't do that. And now they're going to go to the Supreme Court. We'll see where that gets us. But here's the thing. It's bad. Their trade policy is ill-conceived, I doubt even thought out, and just, well, horrible for working people. And here to share some thoughts on maybe what the alternative could be. maybe an idea of what we should be doing as an alternative to what Trump has put forth and an alternative to neoliberal globalization. A lot of problems here. That's why I've asked Adam Hirsch to come talk with us. He's a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. You can check out their website, epi.org. Adam, thanks for taking time for us.
Nice to be with you, Rick.
So walk me through what the court decide. I mean, you know, because some people are going to say, how dare the courts tell our president that he can or can't make trade deals? What'd the court say?
Well, under the Constitution, the authority to regulate trade is given to Congress. But to simplify things, Congress has over time ceded some of that power back to the executive branch. And one way they did it is something called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. The president decided to use this act to justify the tariffs that he imposed on Mexico, Canada, and China with regard to their fentanyl trafficking, as well as to the entire world on the April 2nd Liberation Day tariffs that imposed broad-based tariffs. And what the court said is, no, you don't actually have those powers under the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. Nowhere in that law does it say that, does it use the word tariff as a tool that the president can have to take emergency actions. And so they overturned this. They said this is an illegal overstretch of presidential authority.
So let me back up a little bit, because, you know, I've had a number of people say, well, you just don't understand President Trump. He's playing 3D, 4D. I even heard one person say 5D chess, and I don't even know what that means. But if he is playing 5D chess and I'm still playing checkers, well, am I missing something here? Because, look, I've said before, I'm a tariff guy. I think used in the right context, like any tool, used properly, you know, strategically, it's a good thing. What am I missing here? Where my red hats are going? No, you're just playing checkers, and he's playing 5D.
Yeah, you're not missing anything, Rick. There's really nothing strategic to explain these broad-based on-again, off-again tariffs that the president has been imposing on us for several months. You know, he put tariffs on countries where we have trade surpluses. He put countries on tariffs that aren't really important economically to us. And for much of the time, he let the main offenders of unfair and mercantilist trade practices get off the hook. So he's put these tariffs on when the financial markets have shown that they don't like these, and the stock market's plunged and bond investors have been fleeing the U.S. dollar, sending our interest rates up. He's chickened out and he's backed out. And now Wall Street even has a term for that. They call him a taco. Trump always chickens out. So these haven't really gotten us anything. They're not going to solve the real problems that we have for working people with the way that the U.S. has done globalization with corporate-led trade agreements from NAFTA on down the road. It doesn't fix that, and it's not going to fix that with tariffs.
So this is what I've been saying since the beginning of all this. I say Democrats have got to come up with an alternative. I said they should probably leave D.C., go adopt a Republican district, and come up with a message, a plan, an idea, an alternative vision. What would be the alternative vision on tariffs, on trade? How do we undo the damage that neoliberal globalization has done to the working class of this country? How do you begin to, I think Joe Biden, just to be fair, I think Biden was moving us in that direction slowly, methodically, but what would that look like?
Yeah, we certainly need a different approach, because what we've gotten from these corporate-led trade agreements is not working for a majority of American workers. We knew that this was going to be a problem, a challenge of globalization, even though there are benefits to be gained there. But we could have managed it better, but we didn't. In fact, these corporate trade agreements made it much worse. So we can't just go back to the trade world that we had before Trump went on this tariff binge. We have to have a different approach going forward. And that doesn't preclude the use of tariffs. In fact, tariffs can be and have been very effective tools for promoting manufacturing industrial development, but they have to be used smartly. They have to be used in a strategic and targeted way, not across the entire world with no connection to the challenges that we're facing with different industries, different countries. So we want to leave that in the toolbox, but we have to recognize that those on their own can't solve these problems. We have to take into account all the obstacles that are preventing us having a robust manufacturing sector, preventing us from having jobs with good wages. Although imports from competition from low-wage countries has had a depressing effect on wages of working people, non-college educated workers, it's not relatively, it's a small impact compared to the domestic policies that we've had suppressing wages. So right. If we want to have good jobs, we have to have good labor market institutions. We have to raise the minimum wage and keep it in pace with inflation. We have to have protections for workers to form unions and bargain collectively. We have to have a macroeconomic policy that promotes full employment, because that's the only time when regular workers really see increases in their wages. It happened in the late 1990s. It happened again after we recovered from the great financial crisis in the 2010s. But otherwise, without full employment, we don't have good wage growth. But we need to be dealing with the challenges of globalization. We have to be promoting, rewarding countries that respect labor rights, that protect the environment, and don't use those derogation of those standards to create unfair advantages in trade, put U.S. workers, U.S. industries at disadvantage. Now, under the Biden administration, we were working towards those things. There was definitely were. You know, wasn't perfect, and we could make improvements, but we had combined strategic tariffs with subsidies and other kinds of supports to develop new industries and to promote cleaning the economy and to put U.S. industry and U.S. workers first by having those high standards, insisting that the countries that we trade with abide by those standards. So those are some of the kinds of things that we should be doing instead of just blanket tariffing the world.
Right. And when I talk about tariffs, you know, like one of the tariffs I absolutely agreed with was 100% tariff on Chinese-made EVs. Because when you talk about low-wage countries, we're really talking about China. I mean, all the other ones are nowhere in the same stratosphere as China. They're the weight that is tearing the entire globe down, in my view. So I think they have to be the target of tariffs, of strategic action globally. Look, I don't have a problem if you want to use tariffs to get everybody on board, to pull China in the line, that's great. But if you're going to do what you're saying, which is taking a much high road approach with good wages, good benefits, good working conditions, all those things that as labor guys we want, I still think you got to take on China and bring them into the fold somehow.
Yeah, I mean, China is the elephant in the room, and we need to have a strategic way to approach them. And, you know, we can look at what Trump tried to do in his last administration with the, what was called the Phase One deal. Didn't get us anything. He got promises to buy some American-grown soybeans and some American-extracted liquid natural gas. That's great for those industries, but that's not a strategic policy for building our national economy and having a robust industrial base. Yeah.
But Trump just said the other day he's going to be the guy who opens up China. And my question is does it matter? Do they have the kind of wealth to be able to have a prosperous working class to purchase the things that we make today? And I would argue they don't.
Well, actually, I think they do. I mean, China of today is not the China when they joined the WTO 25 years ago. There's been a tremendous increase in income and wealth and technological sophistication across China. And
I agree with that.
They've gotten there not because they've been stealing our technology, but because they've been making investments in their people, in their infrastructure, in their science, all things that the Trump administration is seeking to cut from us. BYD, now the largest electric vehicle company in the world got there, not from stealing technology, as I said, but because they've been benefiting from subsidies, but also coordinated industrial policy. They didn't steal the technology because we don't have that technology. We were starting to build this industry, and we saw under the Biden administration, and we had a relative manufacturing renaissance in the making. We saw the biggest investments in manufacturing facilities in the history of the United States last year. That's all been thrown out the window when Trump paused the payments for IRA subsidies, and now they look to be on the chopping block under Trump's budget bill moving through Congress.
And, you know, I talked about this the other night on the show. You know, the reality is I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. I remember Carter putting solar panels on the White House and it being this huge thing that, hey, this is the future. I also remember Ronald Reagan coming and ripping them off. I fear we're at that moment again where because of short-sightedness, because of ideology, because of entrenched interests, we lose the next generation of technology and the jobs that go with them. And again, we keep falling further and further behind technologically.
Yeah, and we were just starting to make headway in these areas, including with the use of targeted strategic tariffs for photovoltaic solar panels and other technologies. We were building the domestic manufacturing capacity to have these things. And we're not doing this just to save the environment. We're doing this because these are high tech. There are a lot of jobs and economic spillovers from doing it. And it makes our economy more efficient. It lowers costs, it's going to lower the cost of energy for manufacturing. It's going to lower the cost of energy for homeowners heating and cooling their house. So this is the wave of the future. And if we're not participating in it, not only are we not going to have those jobs, those investments, but we're going to become more beholden on foreign countries to get access to those technologies.
Yeah, I mean, did we learn nothing from the pandemic of how dependent we are on the rest of the world for our supply chain? I mean, that should have been a national call, and it was during the Biden years, but that should have been a national call to action to where it didn't matter, red hat, blue hat, green hat, no hat. You were saying, look, we want to, manufacturing should be a non-political want in this country because, you know, we all went to school and learned about the arsenal of democracy. Maybe it's something we need to learn again. So, but here's where I want to end up with this, because I don't know that I've heard Democrats come with that alternative message of this is the direction we should go. Reflexively, what I've heard from the left and a lot of my Democratic friends is automatic tariffs are bad. This blanket statement that tariffs are bad. And I fear, as I said, you know, months ago, that Trump is going to do this so badly and Democrats are going to parrot the Chamber of Commerce that we'll never use tariffs again as a tool because they will so badly booger it up that we can't use it. That I think that's a part of what we need to be doing, along with what you said, high wage employment, high wage, high road kind of thinking, but also incentives for countries that play along. The carrot and stick idea, and I think tariffs being that stick.
Yeah, look, I mean, and we have in these polluting industries, we have some of the most efficient, cleanest industries in the world. So if we have, if we make a club like the European Union is starting to try to do, like we were doing under the Biden administration, something called the Global Agreement on Sustainable Steel and Aluminum, to keep out and make production that is pollution intensive, to make that pay the price for that, it's going to put U.S. industries at a competitive advantage. So, I mean, we're really taking all the advantages of the U.S. economy and throwing them out the window with this chaotic tariff policy of Trump.
Now, we could do much better. Last question. Are we heading towards recession? I see a lot. I've been hearing the R word for years. Somehow the U.S. economy is resilient enough to keep us out of recession. Are we expecting that?
You know, the forecasters show about a 50-50 chance that we could be heading towards a recession. But this was really before we saw what was coming in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill budget plan of the president and the congressional Republicans. This bill is going to cut so much income away from regular working people while it's undermining the foundations of what cause economic growth, the investments in infrastructure, investments in education, science, making people pay higher costs for healthcare. It's going to have a real impact in slowing down consumption as well as business investment. So I think that's making the likelihood of a recession more likely.
Yeah, they were supposed to be the ones who would bring jobs back. And yet every time I open up the paper or look at a news story, jobs are being lost because of their ill-advised, ill-thought-out, poor planning, or just idiocy. But Adam, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts. Good stuff.
Nice talking to you, Rick.
Adam Hirsch, senior economist there at the Economic Policy Institute. Make sure you check out their work, epi.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Listen to sports coverage from Mike Clemens on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media is your spot for sports. From updates on your favorite teams, live broadcasts of the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, and Bucks, and local sports coverage in your community, we've got everything you need. Find a station near you at civicmedia.us or download the free app today. We'll have more news and talk coming up here on Civic Media's stream.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Michael Negron of the Small Business Majority.
You know, Trump administration thinks that they're doing a solid for small business with their policies. And so having business owners out there talking about how, whether it's tariffs, whether it's potential cuts to health care, how it's going to hurt their bottom line, how it's going to hurt their consumers or their employees. I do think that will have a real impact. Every time he does something, he gets really bad feedback and he retreats in the face of it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons, 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the more we find out about the big, beautiful disaster, the more we don't like it. Evidently, the pledge to end Social Security tax, that's not in there. Evidently, the idea that we're going to cure our budget deficit problems and thus bring down our debt, that's not going to happen, as this is going to cost nearly $4 trillion. All of the promises, the dogs and the puppies, the utopia that we were sold that this was going to be, everyone's going to get a $5,000 doji check because, well, Elon's going to work his magic and it's going to be bliss. Pure utopia. Nobody's going to feel, well, those people will feel some pain, but not you, of course. And now we're finding out, yeah, it is the vast majority of the working class, as the benefits of this disaster, as we knew from the beginning, well, they're going to go to the folks at the top. You know, the people who have bought our government. And here to share some thoughts on how wonderful this big, beautiful bill is, I've asked John Whiten to come talk with us. John's the deputy director over at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. They've got some interesting pieces, some eye-opening pieces. I highly suggest you check out their website, itep.org. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
So how close to utopia is this bill? We were sold a lot. We were all going to have puppies and ponies, and it was ice cream every day. It was going to be beautiful. It was going to be a big, beautiful bill. How wonderful is it?
There's, I think for working people across the country, this is much more like a dystopian novel than any kind of utopia that we're working towards. You know, the bottom line is that this tax package, it's hugely expensive. And it, as you were saying, it's going to most benefit the rich. It's going to be partly paid for by taking away health care and food assistance and other public services from a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, cause it's gonna, but John, that's because they're lazy.
Right, of course.
How dare they be sick and not be able to work?
But that doesn't even pay for it all. It's still going to add, you know, like you said, nearly $4 trillion to the deficit. And, you know,
I think that it's telling the way that this bill came together last week in Congress. You know, it was negotiated very much behind closed doors. It was debated. The two main places it was debated were both through the middle of the night. So when, you know, most of America was asleep, Congress was in there jamming this thing through. And they barely got it through, one vote. And now it moves on to the Senate. So we'll see what happens. But it's it is a disaster of a bill.
But John, are you condemning them for showing up and going to work and staying at the job and until it got done? I mean, you know, they pulled an all-nighter to get this done. You know, that shows at least some gumption, no?
They at least they were there, you know. But I think, you know, it was
like thieves in the night. They passed this thing, and then the reality is there's. When the more that comes to light, and we find out a lot of Republicans didn't read it. Now, I do remember those same Republicans being the ones complaining that they didn't have enough time to read all the other stuff, and they didn't read this. When they had the chance to live their truth and their values, they chose, like thieves in the night, to go along with the big, beautiful idea.
There was no time to read this thing. I say that as, you know, everyone on my team, we're all trying to analyze this thing as it's happening. And it's 1,000 pages, you know.
1,118 when I looked. Wasn't it Nancy Pelosi who said the more you find out about it, the more you're going to like it?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we're having the opposite effect here, I think, as people are learning more about what's in there. There's a lot not to like.
Right. And, walk me through some of it. Clearly, sure. The Social Security tax that we were promised was going to be eliminated. That's not in this. What else isn't in it?
Right. So, I mean, that's not in there. And we can talk a little bit more about what replaces it along with some other things in a minute. Also not in there is any of the really core, you know, economic populism stuff that was out on the trail. I mean, during the presidential campaign, you know, Trump had talked about wanting to possibly bring back a higher top rate for wealthy people. I mean, his proposal was like extremely wealthy people, and it wouldn't have made much of a dent, but it was something.
It was symbolic.
It was symbolic. You know, and that's not in there. And I think it's kind of symbolic between kind of, you know, two factions of the Republican Party at this point, the Steve Bannon kind of side of things and the more, a little bit establishment or Republicans who are kind of controlling things. And they won out in this instance. And there is no higher top rate for, you know, millionaires or multimillionaires. A lot of the stuff, well, first of all, the stuff targeted at working people in this bill, it's, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to what the rich get. First of all, that's always important to remember. Second of all, it's temporary. Almost all of it is temporary. It, you know, the tips, the overtime, the extra deduction for seniors, which is kind of the mechanism they used instead of a Social Security tax piece because they couldn't do that. Those all expire when Trump leaves office. You know what's permanent is the tax cuts for the rich and for corporations.
Because that's really important.
That is the way it works. And that is just kind of a telling fact about this bill.
Yeah, I was looking at one of your pieces over at ITEP.org, written by Carl Davis. And he points out that in, you know, the tax bill in 2027, the top 20% are going to end up with 68% of the cuts going to them. The top 1% is going to get 20. The next 4% are going to get 21. So the top 5% get 41% of all the cuts, and the bottom 20% get one, and the next 20% get four. So 40% of the country gets 5% of the cuts, where the top 5% get 41% of the cuts. The math just—I don't know—it just—it doesn't seem—it doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, no. I mean, you're talking about a situation where, you know, the top 1% is going to get $124 billion in tax cuts in a single year. And the average of that is about 70 grand, right? So the richest 1%, they will make off, you know, on average, about $70,000 better from this bill. And when you get down into, you know, the bottom quintiles, if you will, the bottom 40%, middle 20%, it is significantly less than that. And, you know, there's going to be some people who will probably say, great, a little money in my pocket is great. Okay, sure. But you've got to look at the broader context here. And, you know, there are ways to put a little bit of money in working people's pockets without giving so much to the rich and to profitable corporations.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, you know, John, and I look at this, you know, $70,000 for somebody in our, you know, rarefied air of the top 1%, that's a rounding error in their wealth.
Yeah, sure.
That money could be used in a much better way. You know, if you just gave it to the people at the bottom, it would eventually rise up. And, you know, I used to have an economics professor on the show years ago, Richard Levin. And he said, you know, if you give rich people a tax cut, they're going to go on vacation. If you give poor people a tax cut and you give them the money, they're going to spend it in the rich people's stores, and the money's going to get to them anyway. The difference is you're going to have all this economic activity that's going to help societally. It's going to create jobs. It's going to have economic activity so that, you know, people can put food on the table and support their children and all this stuff. This just seems to be welfare for the rich.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a colleague of mine said earlier the cut, you know, you're talking about how insubstantial it really is, though, for the top 1%. It's a lot of money to everyone else, but it's kind of like the difference between buying like a 15-foot yacht today and a 15.5-foot yacht. You know, it's like it doesn't make that much of a difference, whereas that money that, you know, we're losing either to pay for things like free education or better health care or whatever, or to, you know, if you wanted to do it directly with tax cuts or credits for working people, there's much better ways to spend this money than just kind of continuing to send it to the top.
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, for me, you use a tax code to create some bit of equity, some bit of equality in the system so that it works. This idea, and we've been trying this my entire lifetime, of giving rich people more and more and more with the idea that they're smart, they know what to do with it, and that they're going to be benevolent in some way. And look, they are smart. They do know what to do with it. They make themselves more money. It hasn't trickled down like we were sold. We were told that they were going to create jobs. We were told they were going to invest in new plants and equipment. It was going to be great. And yet all of this utopia they've sold us honestly has been, you know, a dumpster fire nightmare for most working people.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the gaps keep getting wider and wider, you know, the inequality gaps, the wealth gaps in this country. And that has happened with, you know, since the 80s with tax cut after tax cut. And this would only worsen things and continue down that path. But, you know, that's not even like the tax components obviously are a big piece of this bill. But there's like other stuff that's tucked in that's just really kind of outrageous. There's this school vouchers provision in the tax bill. They couldn't figure out a way to get it through by itself, so they needed to put it in this huge package that everyone has to vote for. It's going to create 100% tax deduction for people who give to organizations that support private or religious school vouchers. So where you can get like maybe 33 cents, 35 cents on a dollar for donating to, you know, your local veterans support organization or your local homeless shelter or whatever. If you give to this voucher organization, you get 100% of that. You get a dollar back for every dollar you put in. And they also created a capital gains like tax dodge loophole in there. So you can actually make money by doing it if you're, you know, extremely wealthy and you've got the right sort of investment strategist telling you what to do. So there's just kind of no end to the outrageous things in this bill that really are going to all, you know, reward the top.
Yeah, no, look, in 1118 pages, there are tons of Easter eggs in there. There's tons of what we used to call pork barrel spending, only these are ideological pet projects and ideas that our wealth class I'm sure we'll use very well, the education component part of it. You know, who wouldn't want Elon Musk to run a series of schools to ensure our children think exactly like he does?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That is the kind of future that which we're headed to if this bill continues down the path, I guess.
So what are the chances of that happening? Look, there's a lot in this. The more we find out about it, the more that even the red hats aren't thrilled.
Right.
What are the chances of this getting through the Senate as is, or do they make enough substantial changes that, you know, going back, you know, that just this ends up being tanked? What are your thoughts?
You know, I don't know. It's clear that the Senate wants a different kind of bill. There's some things, you know, that, as it goes, some of the things they want to do are worse, and some of the things they want to do are sort of more sensible. So it's a mixed bag in terms of whether they want to improve or make the bill worse. We'll see what they do, but there's no question they're not taking the House bill and just running with it. They're doing their own thing. And then it's going to have to go back. And, you know, the House, you've just got this one vote, you know, that they got through in the first place. So I think it's hard to say what will happen. But I do think, you know, it was unclear if it would pass the House.
Right.
And, you know, I think Trump really put his finger on the scales and helped get it through. And I think he will continue to do that. I mean, this is a if this were to not happen, this would be a spectacular failure.
No, and look, you know,
for so early in his presidency.
Certainly, but, you know, as Republicans are going home into their districts, I don't know if you've
noticed. They're hearing about it.
I don't know if you've noticed, but they're not coming home to flowers and parades and warm hugs and kisses. They're getting yelled at. They're getting booed. They're getting their what for.
Right, and I think that's completely the key point and the sort of key take home right now. It's like, you know, if you're out there, you're listening to this, you're watching, you know, stay informed about what's going on and keep up the pressure because it's not over, right? And even with your House members, like they voted once, they're going to have to vote on something again.
Yeah.
So, you know, whoever you're in with, whether it's your rep, your senators, call them all the time, go to the rallies. You know, a lot of our allies and partners have been doing a great job getting people out and helping to show that this is vastly unpopular.
Yeah, I had said, you know, at the beginning of his administration that, you know, the only thing they got through during his first term was that horrible tax bill back then. And just right. Barely, I said this time, I didn't think anything was going to actually get through. I thought they would eventually eat themselves. And I still think I'm right. I still think that this is so bad that as Republicans go home to their districts, there are a couple of them are go, hey, I want to keep my seat. All of these people are telling me I'm going, especially as these Medicaid cuts more come to light, especially as the, you know, the SNAP cuts come to light. There's all of the 1,118 pages of Easter eggs come to light. I think there's going to be one or two, and that's all it's going to take within the narrow margin they've got.
Yeah, it will not take much to end up, you know, putting this thing in the shredder. And if, you know, if that's the case, so be it. You know, I think we'll be in a much better place.
I think we'd better off with nothing than what this is.
Yeah.
Just my thoughts.
Yeah. 100%.
John, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out the website, ITEP.org. Lots of good information, especially on this tax bill, because this is their specialty.
That's but John, what we do.
I appreciate the time, man.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
John's the deputy director at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policies, ITEP.org, the website, if you want to see the work that they do. And, well, all of the great digging they've done on this. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you ready for the big, beautiful bill, or could this be the big, beautiful implosion? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day that came to be known as the Republic Steel Massacre or the Memorial Day Massacre in Chicago, Illinois. Workers had gathered to rally for a union at the Republic Steel plant. The crowd included men, women, and children, and began with a festive holiday atmosphere. But soon the festivity gave way to horror as police opened fire, shooting indiscriminately into the crowd of workers. 10 workers were slain. Many others were injured. The violence was caught by a film camera, which captured chilling scenes of policemen beating workers with clubs as they tried to flee the violence. One of those workers was a woman by the name of Guadalupe Marshall. Lupe had come to the United States from Mexico in 1917. At the time of the strike, she was working for the famed Chicago Hull House, researching the conditions of Mexican workers in the city. During the massacre, she was wounded in the head. She was then shoved into a patrol wagon, where she tried to help other wounded people. One of the wounded died in her arms. Later, she testified before the U.S. Senate Committee of Education and Labor about what she saw that day. She said, quote, "As we were walking along to the patrol wagon, I noticed men lying all over the field. Some of them were motionless, some were groaning, but nearly all of those that were lying down had their heads covered with blood and their clothing was stained with blood." The Senate committee helped expose what happened that bloody day in Chicago. The local newspaper blamed the violence on the workers, and the film of the event was suppressed by the city.
Republic's bloody ground, the 30th of May. Oh, brothers, lift your voices high for them that died that day. The men who make our country steel, the toilers in the mill, they said in union.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So President Taco has chickened out again, this time. He's walking away from banning foreign students from attending Harvard. Now, you know, this comes after a judge said that, no, you can't issue an executive order, banning foreign students from enrolling in Harvard. The ruling, they say, was a win, at least temporarily, for the university in its ongoing confrontation with the White House, which has waged an all-out battle to undermine Harvard's finances and global influence, according to the New York Times. Now, this is the weird thing, because what you've got is Trump, who's fixated on Harvard. And I don't know why. In fact, he's going so far as, I guess Melania said that Barron didn't even apply, which, I don't know. I don't know that I'm buying that. But this is the weird thing. Trump feels slighted, I think. He says that they're treating the country with great disrespect. He said, Harvard wants to fight. They want to show how smart they are, and they're getting their behinds kicked, he says. He says all they're doing is getting it deeper and deeper and deeper. They've got to behave themselves. And that's the thing. This is what fascistic dictators don't like. They don't like being questioned. They certainly don't like losing, which he is doing a ton of. This is an interesting back and forth. Also, you've got an administration who's on board. Linda McMahon, the education secretary, was quoted on CNBC saying, universities, this is weird. Universities should continue to be able to do research as long as they're abiding by the law and in sync, I think, with the administration and what the administration is trying to accomplish. Really? Is that what we want education for, Linda McMahon, Secretary of Education? Gotta have to go along with what the administration's goals are? So maybe when your health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy, says in his Make America Healthy Again Commission that... how did he put it? They've harnessed the gold standard of science and cited, 500 studies. The only problem is a lot of the citations, massive number of errors, broken links, misstated conclusions. And oh, by the way, 7 of the cited stations, cited sources don't even freaking exist. I think the whole commission report was written by a right-wing version of AI, but is this what education is for? You can only do what the administration, what dear leader, what King Donald wants you to do. Is that the future that we want? And I don't care. Take your hats off. Red hat, blue hat, green hat. I don't care. Is this what you think education should be? That you only think with blinders on in an ideological way? Me, I grew up at a time where you wanted a wide breadth of education, a very liberal arts kind of education, so that you understood a little bit about everything. You know, the jack of all trades mantra. I know a lot of people have said, well, it's a master of none. Yeah, but if you go and you read the rest of the poem, that's a pretty, being a jack of all trades, pretty good thing. And Americans used to think that way. Not so much anymore. We only seem to think, according to Linda McMahon and Robert Kennedy's study, is if it's ideological, then we're good. And don't question our ideology, because one, we can't defend it. And this is where I keep coming back to, is this what we want? Do we want universities that are going to behave, know their place? Look, I may not agree with everything being taught in every classroom across the country, but I'll tell you, I want my kids exposed to a wide array of thoughts, and I want them questioning those things, and I want them debating and arguing and coming to some kind of conclusion for themselves. Because my kids' generation is moving towards an era where, with AI, we're going to have the Linda McMahons and the RFK Juniors dictating what our kids think, what they see, what they hear, what they read. And this idea that we're going to give massive tax breaks to people who want to start ideological schools so we can train little Christian warriors or little corporate warriors or whatever. That's dangerous. And I'll tell you, we got a lot of work. So when I see this story about Steve Bannon, and I believe, you know, Steve Bannon is one of the worst people in politics. I think he is advocating for something that is very dangerous for this country. I think that he is doing things that, quite frankly, their goals are to undermine democracy. So when he calls on Donald Trump to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, of which our Secretary of Homeland Security doesn't even know the definition, I'm worried. Because the reality is, most people don't know what habeas corpus is. Most people don't know that when the government snatches you up, they have to tell you why. When they're taking you off to jail, they got to say why they're taking you off to jail. You have a right to your day in court. You have a right to due process. Right now, we have those rights. They want to do away with that. And understand, right now, it's, well, we're going to go get those immigrants. We're going to go get those illegals. And look, if there are people here who are illegal, if there are people who have broken the law, then you do it the right way. You do it within the confines of our legal system. You don't allow a president to just burn the Constitution because of its expedience. So this idea that just for now, you know, we're gonna suspend these rights, you got to ask yourself, when are you next? How long does it go? I'm telling you, we've got a lot going on. The way of life that we've grown up to believe in is being stripped away as we speak. These people are serious. They hate democracy. They hate the people. And yet, they're the first ones yelling, we the people! And when they say we the people, they mean them. They don't mean all of us. They mean the handfuls of them and their ideology, not you and me. Not average, everyday working people. Not people who are just trying to get by. These are the rich people. These are the control arm of this country, the oligarchs. Because they don't want the unwashed masses. They don't want an educated populace. They don't want children who are too educated to work. Because, you know, a little too much education spoils children for work. They want pliable. They want desperate. They want exploitable. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their communities dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.